From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the director of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ragtime, Hair, and Amadeus. Milos Forman tells us about growing up in Czechoslovakia, where life under the Gestapo was a tragedy, then life under the communists was absurd. As a young filmmaker, Forman helped to create the Czech New Wave Cinema, making internationally acclaimed films within the state-run industry. One of those films, Fireman's Ball, ended up being his ticket out of Czechoslovakia. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about how the French are trying to keep their language pure by enacting new rules to ban foreign words from public use. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Mexican Attorney General's office says at least seven people are involved in the assassination of presidential candidate Luis Donaldo Colosio. They include four men who'd been hired to guard Colosio during his campaign appearance in Tijuana, where he was shot March 23rd. The man who confessed to firing the shots told police that he went to the rally alone, but he also says he's part of an unspecified political group that reportedly has thousands of members. Colosio was seen as a shoo-in for the August election. Israel is preparing to withdraw its troops from Gaza and Jericho. The pullout is expected to be rapid, but long-delayed talks over details of Palestinian autonomy have to be settled first. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli army continues to dismantle bases and move equipment out of Gaza and Jericho. Israeli sources say the army will be able to withdraw from Jericho in 24 hours and from Gaza in 3 days once the self-rule agreement is signed. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Barakat said, for the first time, Palestinians are seeing tangible signs of progress, and there will be more this week. The first Palestinian police are expected in the next 4 days, and 46 Palestinians expelled by the Israelis are being allowed to return home. Most of them were grassroots leaders who became PLO officials, and a former negotiator says they're coming back to both consolidate the authority of Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization and to further demonstrate to Palestinians that peace with Israel will bring benefits. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Grumman's board of directors has unanimously approved a tender offer from Northrop. The offer is worth $62 per share for Grumman common stock. It's $2 more than the original offer that Northrop made a month ago. It's also $7 a share better than an offer from Martin Marietta, which had been approved before Northrop entered the bidding process. Grumman's chairman says the Northrop offer is an excellent deal for shareholders. The State Department says cocaine use is declining in the United States, but heroin use is up. State Department spokesman Mike McCurry says there's been a steady increase in the flow and purity of heroin to the United States in the last few years, and Latin American drug traffickers are getting ready to cash in. McCurry says the Clinton administration is serious about stopping drug trafficking and will be taking a close look at countries that violate drug trafficking standards.
My message to countries that did not receive full certifications is that this administration will not conduct business as usual on narcotics certifications decisions. We will be taking a hard look at their anti-drug efforts and the efforts of all the major drug-producing and transit countries again next year.
McCurry says heroin could be to the 1990s what cocaine was to the 1980s. On Wall Street, it's been a rocky day. The Dow is down 47 points at 3,588. This is NPR. Reports of a second gunman in the Hebron Mosque during a massacre of Muslim worshippers is getting more support. An Israeli police expert says one shell found at the site was fired from a rifle that has not been found. He says he's traced 114 other bullets to weapons that have been recovered. A Jewish extremist who was beaten to death after the shootings has been blamed for the murders, but Palestinian witnesses have repeatedly insisted there was more than one gunman. President Clinton will be on hand tonight when the NCAA basketball championship is decided. The Arkansas Razorbacks are favored over their opponents, the Duke Blue Devils. Kathy Merritt of member station WFAE reports.
Arkansas has been ranked number one for much of the season. Coach Nolan Richardson says his group of young players is on a mission, and they've worn down opponents all year with an approach he calls 40 minutes of hell. By contrast, Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski did not expect to make it to the title game, but he has been there before, winning in 1991 and 92. The game will bring some 23,000 people to the Charlotte Coliseum, including Razorback fan Bill Clinton. He attended Saturday's semifinal, causing many fans to wait in long lines to get through security checks. Officials are working to keep that from happening again tonight. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Merritt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The Disney Company has lost its president in an accident. Frank Wells was killed yesterday when the helicopter he was riding in crashed into a Nevada mountain. Wells is credited with helping the Disney Company achieve box office success with films that appeal to adults and children. Disney CEO Michael Eisner has released a statement saying he has no adequate words to express his sense of loss. Eisner and Wells were recruited as a team to improve Disney's fortune. The firm says Disney's stock rose 1,500% while they were there. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Academy Award-winning director Milos Forman. His movies include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, Amadeus, and Valmont. Forman began his career working under the communist bureaucracy in his native country, Czechoslovakia. His Czech movie, Fireman's Ball, played at the New York Film Festival in 1967 and was his ticket to the U.S. Forman has written a memoir called Turnaround. Forman was a child during World War II when the Gestapo were in charge. After the war in 1948, the communists took over. Both of Forman's parents died in Nazi death camps. His father was on the fringes of the underground. One of the Nazis responsible for the death of Forman's parents had been one of their employees years before.
My parents built a very small 15-room pension, or little hotel, if you want, in former Sudetenland, which was the part of Czechoslovakia which was taken over by the Nazis first, by the Germans first. And as a kind of a foreman on the building of this pension in 1920-something, I was not even born, was a German citizen there who, and I know that my parents were very fair people and they treated him fairly, but when the Nazi came to power, suddenly this man, of course, was somehow humiliated that he worked for some Czechs, which is, you know, not a race or nation, which is, you know, up to the Nazi or German stature. And by sheer coincidence, this man ended up in the Gestapo in Kolín, which was the town under which Czaslav, a little town in the middle of Bohemia, was under. And when he got all these names, and he saw the names of my parents, first my father and then my mother, he just stamped the paper with a stamp which said the return undesirable. And that's it. And then they perished.
Your mother was taken by the Gestapo after they came to search your house. What was it like? You were, I think, 7 years old or something?
With mother, I was 8 and a half. Yeah, I was 8 and a half years old. I was sick that day, and I was, I had a fever, I had a flu, I was in bed, and I heard, you know, that some voices downstairs, because we were living in a little house, you know, one-story house in Czaslav, and for a long time, and I knew that something is strange, because I heard the strange noises from downstairs, and then I hear steps coming upstairs, and then the door open a crack, and my mother is there, and she's handing me a cup of water and a pill, and says, no, take the pill, and I said, but I shouldn't be taking the pill until the afternoon. The Gestapo is here. And she just gave me that, so I took the pill, and I, you know, the door closed, and I saw a man standing behind her there. And then I realized why she's telling me that, because I was my bedroom was a tiny little room behind which was another tiny little room to which the door were covered by a cupboard. And to keep the fresh air in, the cupboard was always a little bit away from the door. And I realized that she wants me to push the cupboard back to the wall so that it covers the door. And when they come to my bedroom for search, that they will not find it. But I was too weak, and the cupboard was oak wood and very, very heavy. I took all the things out, and I was trying to push it back and push it back, and I didn't succeed. That was the most horrible feeling because I felt like I failed my family. The irony is that then when they came in and found out, you know, this other room there, they went in, they looked around, they went out, they were even smiling at me. And then they went down again with my mother. But then I hear the door click, and then there was silence. And this was, you know, they came like 8 o'clock in the morning, and this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was silence. And I hear the car going away from in the street, and there is a total silence. They just didn't even let my mother go upstairs and say goodbye. And I am alone, absolutely alone in the whole house. And there was nobody in the town of Čáslav, you know, who would come home.
So that's the last time you ever saw your mother?
No, then we had a very, you know, sort of, it's everything is such paradox, you know. About a year later, suddenly we were allowed a visit with our mother. Me, my brother, and my uncle, you know, my mother's brother. So we went to Prague. We were taken down to the catacombs of a former bank, which was now at Gestapo headquarters in Prague. And we are, they, you know, locked us in, closed the door, and we are sitting there, my brother, my uncle, for about over 2 hours. And then the door opens, and in the door, they brought in my mother. And from the, in the first moment, I realized she didn't know why where they are taking her. They obviously didn't tell her that she's not going to be interrogated or whatever, that she's going to meet her family. And we had 10 minutes allowed with her. And the funny paradox is that, you know, what do you... Now when I recall it, all we were talking about, mother was asking, oh, how were the prunes this year? And did you have enough sugar to make a jam? And how is Mrs. Procházková? It was absolute, and she was just holding me all these 10 minutes, you know. And then the man said, you know, goodbye, and say goodbye. So the mother left, never saw her again.
So what was it like for you to go through the rest of the war without parents?
Well, that's another big paradox. You know, a child doesn't really perceive the tragedy like that. Especially, you know, I probably would be much more stricken by grief if my parents died yesterday than when they died when I was a child. And because child doesn't really perceive the finality of life. The death is, especially in these cases, because they were away. They were somewhere.
Right, you didn't know they were going to die.
So you don't know they are going to die. They are somewhere. And then one day, somebody tells you, in this case it was my uncle, told me, listen, my sister, your mother died. But in my daily life, nothing changed. You know.
So you had family, extended family to bring you up, uncle.
Oh, my relatives were taking care of me, yes.
I want you to recall a specific day during the war, and this is a day that must have had special significance for you. It's the day that the Germans decreed that all the art houses had to close, the theater, the ballet, the orchestra, the movies. Were you already interested in the arts when that happened?
I was very much. Well, not interested. I was seduced because I was a child again. You know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old. And my brother, who is 12 years older than I am, he was like 23 years old. He was a set designer for a traveling small group, theater group company, which was playing operettas. And every time when they came to town where I was living with my relatives, you know, I was every day, I was backstage. And, you know, I was just mesmerized by the atmosphere of the theater. And, because I was a little kid, you know, nobody kicked me out from the ladies' dressing room, right? So that was very, very exciting. And then, you know, I didn't know anything, you know, why it's happening. It was the most weird experience because I remember very well, Polish Blood is the name of the operetta. It's a very fluffy, light operetta. And this was 1944. And suddenly in the third act, during a very merry kind of a song, it was like a quartet or a quintet, and the ballet dancers and things on the stage, suddenly the singers stopped singing and started to cry, tears running down. And the orchestra stopped, conductor stopped. The people in the theater were sitting silently, quietly. Nobody was sort of upset or surprised. I just didn't know what's happening. Then the conductor tried to start the aria or the quintet again. They started to try to sing again this very merry, happy song. And again, in the middle of the song, they broke down and in tears and cried. And then the man came on the stage and said, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you understand the emotional state of the artist who will not be able to finish the performance today. Thank you for coming. It was so nice. Good night. And the curtain went down, and that was the end of culture. Because I didn't know that the day before, the Germans just canceled culture. The next day, every single singer, every single dancer, every single musician had to go and enlist himself or herself in a factories to work for the victory of the Third Reich.
My guest is film director Miloš Forman. He's written a new memoir called Turnaround. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Miloš Forman is the director of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, and Amadeus. He's written a new memoir called Turnaround.
Let me skip ahead to a few years after World War II, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia. Do you have specific memories of that?
I remember that, you know, it's, again, very, very strange thing to realize. I remember I was in the boarding school, and I was in the fifth grade, and of the gymnasium, which was, you know, and we were traveling from the school in the nature, from the mountains, and when we were standing and waiting for another train on the train station in Mladá Boleslav, where from the loudspeakers is coming a speech by the then you know, Communist Party chairman Gottwald, announcing that the communists took over the country. We just you know, before we had any time to absorb the propaganda of this evasive social justice which the communists based their propaganda on, we didn't have time to be influenced by it. So when we heard this speech, we realized that this is totally hypocritical, you know, and unreal.
Were there things that you liked to do as a boy that you couldn't do after the communists took over because it was too bourgeois?
I never thought about these kind of things. You know, you adjust, especially in the communist society, because there are no alternatives. You mm-hmm. know, it's you are told what you can do, what you can't do, and if you don't want to do what you can do, you are not allowed to do anything. So you adjust, you know, you just accept the limitations imposed on you.
You ended up trying to go to theater school. You were rejected from theater school and ended up in film school, which I suppose was really lucky.
Well, for me, definitely.
Lucky break, yeah. Had you seen a lot of movies growing up?
Oh, yeah, in the film school. It was another paradox of communist society because it was the best school I could ever be going into because after the communists took over, they purged from public life the best writers, the best filmmakers, the best artists in the country because they were not enough in creating in the vein of socialist realism for them, so they purged them. But they couldn't kill them. They had to give them some chance to make a living. So make a meager living in teaching. They were not allowed to publish anything publicly, to books or make movies or work in the theater. But they were allowed to gain meager salary as professors. So the result was that at the film school we had the best minds, the greatest artists, which were teaching us, which we could talk to.
Milan
Kundera was one of them.
Yeah, wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being was one of your teachers.
Yes, Book of Laughter and Forgetting, The Joke, you know, wonderful books.
One of the things that you did, I think this was while you were in film school or just afterwards,
You hosted what you describe as a sort of Czech socialist realist Thursday night at the movies show on TV. So what was the show like? What made it the social realist version?
Well, the social realist version was that, first of all, the paranoia and of the communists to control every word which goes to the public, and television was only live. In that time, there was not Ampex and tapes at all, so it had to be live. So but they had to control everything. So you had to write everything down, learn it by heart, word by word. The censor was sitting somewhere watching you, checking if you are saying exactly the words which you had to send the text to the office, to the Bureau of Censors. They had to put a stamp on it, send it back to you, eventually make some corrections, Then you had to learn it by heart, and then they were checking if you are saying it exactly, which was sometimes absolutely ridiculous because you are sort of, I was doing it like a improvised, like a live dialogue, conversation with somebody.
So what would you say to introduce a film? Do you remember any of the introductions you did?
All the introductions had to, I was always trying to show on the television films which had some, which were not just the propaganda films, but then, of course, that you had to present them in the way which the communists would accept. If it was film from France, for example, Children of Paradise, beautiful, romantic film, but you had to stress that this film is showing the cruelty of bourgeoisie, how it's suppressing the working class people,
Did you believe any of that?
Of course not.
But you learned to say it.
Well, you say it because, it's because everybody knew it's nonsense.
Right.
It's a game. It's
right.
A game,
When you started writing and directing movies, did you have to avoid what government officials would have defined as bourgeois subject matter?
Well, that was something else. When you do the movies, I tried not to speculate what would please them. And I was lucky because for some reasons, they think, my first films were comedies, basically, in films in Czechoslovakia. And they perceive comedies as something not as important, something light, make it, it's just funny, it's just like that. So I was able to do these films very much the way I wanted to do them.
What kind of taste in movies did the cultural apparatchiks have?
Oh, that's how it's wonderful to work hard and to surpass the outcome of steel from his steel mill 10% more than the steel mills in capitalist bourgeois decadent society. That was the greatest art. Now the basic, the basic dilemma or paradox or discrepancy in the art philosophy is that what we are doing here, we are telling stories about life as it is, while the communist propaganda wants to tell and describe in the books or on the screen the life as it should be according to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so boring, you can't imagine.
One of the best known of your Czechoslovakian films was Fireman's Ball. And this was a comedy. And in the version that's in circulation now, I don't know when you put this part in. I mean, I know you put it in the late 60s. The film opens with you in front of the camera explaining that, first of all, Fireman's Ball was released just before the Dubček leadership took over, and that the film had a very surprising reaction. 40,000 firemen resigned in protest against this film.
Well, they were ordered to resign. This film was banned. This film was banned right away when it was finished, and was banned, officially written for eternity.
No, why was it banned? You said comedies weren't considered as dangerous. Is this a comedy?
Well, they thought it's a metaphor on the Politburo and the Communist Party, that Fireman's Ball Committee, right? That it's a metaphor for the whole leadership of the country, so they banned the film. That was orchestrated by the government people, this strike or the threat of practically all the volunteer firemen in the whole country to. Because they needed, the people were so apathetic already, they didn't give a damn. But of course, if the people read in the newspapers that, tomorrow, if your house is on fire, just say, give the house goodbye, because the firemen are on strike, rightly, because they are upset about this film. So, that turns people's anger against the artists, against the films, filmmakers,
Were there any fires that you were accused of being personally responsible for? And did you feel responsible for any of it?
No. They didn't go on strike.
Oh, they didn't really go on strike.
They provoked this threat so that the government can say that they have a right to ban the film. So when the government banned the film, the firemen said, all right, so now we know that.
Director Miloš Forman is my guest. Now, where were you when the Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia?
I was in Paris in that time. I was in Paris working on a script for my first American movie. And that's where I learned about it.
And your family was still in Czechoslovakia?
My family was still there, but my French friends, Claude Berry and Paul Rassam, drove in car, which they borrowed from François Truffaut, to Prague to bring my wife and my children out. It was such a ridiculously, absurdly funny story, because they crossed the, everything was fine, but when they crossed the border, the Czech population, when the Russian army, was occupying the country, just to confuse the Russians. So they either turned down or turned around all the street signs, all the signs on the roads, on the crossroads and everything. So there was no way so that the Russians are confused and couldn't find anything. And it really took, several weeks before they found some places of their interest. So when Claude Berry and Paul Rassam crossed the border going to Prague, suddenly they found themselves, driving around and around, seeing deja vu places because all the, signs on the roads were wrong. When they realized that they, tried to stop some people, and finally they stopped the motorcyclist who said, oh, yeah, I'm going to Prague, just follow me. And he started to drive. So they are now driving, following this motorcyclist. And in the middle of this wild ride through the countryside, the Pole suddenly had an urge to take a leak, right? So he said to Claude, stop, I have to take a leak. What do you mean to stop? I stop and, we lose him, we'll never find Prague. Well, what was this? Well, just open the window, roll around the window, do it out of the window. So he climbed into the back seat of the car, and when he's doing it out of the rear window of the car, suddenly a colony of Russian tanks is coming against, And they, they could take this as a provocation. So Claude, by driving the car, the car just grabbed, Paul and just, pulled him back into the car. And, he just sprinkled all over the François Truffaut's new Daimler, car. But then finally they reached Prague and they brought my wife and my children out.
Film director Miloš Forman, his new memoir is called Turnaround. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Miloš Forman will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Milos Forman, director of Ragtime, Hair, Amadeus, and Mozart. He'll tell us how he came to direct One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and how that film connects to his own brief stay in a Czech mental hospital. The French have enacted new rules to prevent the seepage of foreign words into their language. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us how those rules are affecting the culture now that English has been banned from French advertising, TV programs, and more. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The stock market was quite volatile today. Traders say sell orders flooded into the market after a three-day Easter weekend. The Dow then seesawed all day, finally closing down 42 points at 3,593. Robert Stovall is an economic analyst who says the American market trend is spreading overseas to foreign stock markets.
This is a communicable disease. The United States market is still the world's largest, and the troubles we're having with stocks and bonds here in the States has caused weak markets abroad, led by selling in U.S. shares that are listed abroad. So if you look around the world, you'll see that most of the markets are sustaining selling pressure.
Thousands of children visited the White House this morning to take part in the annual Easter egg roll. President Clinton blew the whistle that sent the kids scrambling for 30,000 speckled wooden eggs.
I am so glad to see all of you here. I woke up before dawn this morning, and when I got out just at dawn, I already saw the Easter bunnies out here walking around, plotting their strategies for the day and getting ready.
Many of the eggs were decorated with a picture of the White House and signatures of the Clintons. Others had the signatures of celebrities like Tom Selleck, Barbara Streisand, and Socks the Cat. Mrs. Clinton was on hand, and she also welcomed the children.
One of the things that we do at the Easter egg roll is to continue the tradition that started way, way back when President Madison was president of the United States, and his wife, Dolly Madison, started the Easter egg roll. And we think that it's wonderful that you can be doing things that children did nearly 200 years ago, about 180 or 90 years ago, and every year since then.
The Supreme Court is going to hear a case involving a consumer and airlines' rights. The justices will decide if airlines can be sued under state consumer protection laws when they redesign their frequent flyer programs. American Airlines frequent flyers have sued that airline. They're challenging new retroactive rules that limit the number of seats available to program members and the dates they can fly. The Illinois Supreme Court says the suit is legal under state law, but Americans says a federal law doesn't allow state suits. It also says they threaten the economic stability of the industry. Bosnian Radio reports the town, city of Garajda is under Bosnian Serb attack. The head of the UN peacekeepers has plans to visit the city on Wednesday, but it's not clear what he can do. There are only four military observers in Garajda, and the UN cannot act as the Bosnian Serbs continue to shell the city. Garajda is one of six areas that received the safe city designation by the UN last year. The Dow Jones Industrials fell to their lowest close of the year today, down 42 points to end at 3,593. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR. There are 3 weeks to go before South Africa's first all-race elections, and the country's political leaders will meet later this week to try to find ways to stop the pre-election violence. President F.W. de Klerk, Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, African National Congress President Nelson Mandela, and Zulu King Goodwill Zwelithini meet on Friday for a peace summit. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports from Johannesburg.
The summit meeting is expected to go ahead on Friday next with the three main leaders present, as well as the Zulu King, Goodwill Zwelithini. According to one government source, the postponement of regional elections in Natal is a possibility which would be considered if this meant that Chief Buthelezi and his supporters eventually took part in the elections. There's been no word yet from ANC sources on this suggestion. However, given that Mr. Mandela has repeatedly said elections cannot be put off, it would be difficult for him to now ask his supporters in Natal to accept a delay. There would also be practical difficulties. There would be nothing to stop people from Natal going to vote in regional elections in any of the other provinces and then voting again several weeks later when the Natal poll takes place. A statement from the ANC in response to the rumours may come later today.
Fergal Keane reporting. Japan says it wants to resume trade talks with the United States in a few weeks. A Japanese government spokesman says there could be a meeting between the Japanese foreign minister and the U.S. trade representative. Both men are scheduled to be in Morocco this month for world trade talks. Official trade talks with Japan have broken down. They've been suspended since February. South Korea is not fully accepting U.S. claims that North Korea already has an atomic bomb. A South Korean foreign ministry spokesman says there's no clear evidence that's true. Defense Secretary William Perry has told NBC that the CIA believes North Korea has at least one weapon, and possibly two. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Academy Award-winning director Milos Forman. His films include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, and Amadeus. Forman is from Czechoslovakia, where he made his first internationally acclaimed films, Loves of a Blonde and The Fireman's Ball. In the second part of our interview, we talk about Forman's American films. The second film you made in the United States, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is one of your most famous films that got a bunch of Academy Awards. You keep stressing the absurdity of stories that surrounded life under communism in Czechoslovakia. And you found out that you had been sent a copy of the novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest years before you actually made the movie, but you never got it.
Well, that was Kirk Douglas who bought the rights for the book, you know, when it was even before it was published. And he loved the book and he wanted to make a movie, but never succeeded to get money to do it. But in that times, he was still hoping to do it. And he was in Prague on a goodwill mission, which was originated by President Kennedy. And he came to Prague because he did the adaptation of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for Broadway, Kirk Douglas. And he starred in it on Broadway. And even there, you know, this adaptation at that time flopped. So suddenly he had time on his hands. So he accepted to go to Eastern Europe and Central Europe. So he went to Prague. They showed him one of my films. He liked it, and he asked me at the party if he can send me a book and if I would read it and tell him, you know. I said, of course, of course, of course. And, you know, the book never came, so I thought, well, that he, well, you know, another American big shot, you know. The moment he left the room, he already forgot. And okay. 10 years later, I'm already here in the United States, and I get a book in an envelope sent by the producers, Saul Zenz and Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas's son, if I would read it, and that was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And, well, you know, I said yes, it was the most fascinating, intelligent piece of literature in the times I was offered and read. And when few weeks later I met Kirk, he said, "You Czechs, you son of a bitches." I said, why are you saying that? Well, listen, I was sending you 10 years ago this book, and you don't have even a courtesy to say, you know, kiss off or something like that. And I told him, well, listen, this is, you know, the same thing I thought about you. Well, what happened was he sent the book, but the censors at the customs confiscated the book as a subversive literature without informing Kirk Douglas that the book, or sending it back to Kirk Douglas, and without informing me.
So did Michael Douglas, when he sent you the book, did he know that his father had sent it to you 10 years before?
That's the funny thing. No, he didn't. It was some kind of a strange fate that the book came back again to me by Kirk's son and Saul Zenz, you know.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is, of course, set in a mental hospital. And you tell a really interesting story in your book about your experience in such an institution in Czechoslovakia. You say this was during a period when it was almost fashionable to have a nervous breakdown because then you could kind of
take a break for a while and get a little bit of rest. And so you had checked in to an institution for a while, and you met somebody there, and I'll let you tell the story.
Well, it was not only fashionable, it was some kind of a self-protection, because in case you got in trouble with the authorities on the ideological front, it was somehow better if you could say, oh, I'm not, you know, I'm a little mentally disturbed. I have a, I have a record of being treated in mental hospital, you know.
I see, uh-huh.
So for that reason, I was, you know, going there, and of course I had to, you know, pretend some symptoms so that they can really administer me something real. And they were putting in, you know, me intravenously some kind of, I don't know, I guess it was some kind of a sedative or I don't know. What was it? It was once a week I went there and I lie down on the bed in a room where there was like 40 other beds with the real patients there, you know, in their gowns, you know, hanging around. And for about half an hour I'm lying there and while the, you know, this stuff is going into my vein. And one day this rather young, good-looking guy came. And, you know, I learned one thing, which then I used, which very much formed my vision of Cuckoo's Nest. Before I entered the mental institution, went inside, I had a very ridiculous idea, because what I was expecting, you know, people hanging on the chandeliers and yelling, I am Jesus Christ, and going bananas. And here I entered, you know, this institution there in Prague, and I see these poor souls with it, trying desperately to look normal, you know. And only then, and so this guy comes and he looks like very normal and he says, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm making films. And he says, oh, I hate them. That's why I'm here. I said, why? Well, because, you know, they got my wife. They want my wife to be in the films. My wife didn't want to go and make films. She wanted to stay with me, but they want, because they want to, can I say these words on radio or not? You know, they want to have to abuse her, and so they so that I can protect her, they locked me here in the mental institution. Well, my wife is there with them, but I'll get out of here and I'll show them. I'll show them. Do you know my wife? I said, well, you didn't know. You didn't tell me who she is. Well, Jana Brejková. And that was my wife he's talking about. So I suddenly realized that this, you know, rather reasonably, rationally looking guy is totally out of it.
Yeah, his delusion was that he was married to your wife.
He was delusion that he was married to my wife.
So what did you say? How did you handle that?
I said, oh, yeah, everybody knows Jana Brejková. Well, just tell them. Tell them when I'll get out, I'll get even with them. So I'll tell them, sure, I'll tell them, yeah.
Did you tell your wife the story?
Oh, yeah.
What was
yeah.
her reaction to
well,
it?
Well, she was scared.
My guest is film director Miloš Forman. He's written a new memoir called Turnaround. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Film director Miloš Forman is my guest. He has a new memoir called Turnaround. I want to move on to your film Ragtime, which was, I can't remember if it was the last or just one of the last films that James Cagney was in.
That was, well, for the big screen, the last one, yes. He then after that did one film for television.
I mean, Americans have always thought of Cagney as, you know, like an icon of movies. What about growing up in Czechoslovakia? Were you familiar with his work from there?
No, not at all, because his films were not played in Europe. I'll tell you why.
Oh, because it glorified gangsters, right?
No. I mean, even before the war or even in the archives, we didn't have his films.
Oh.
because James Cagney, James speaks so fast. It's such a rapid-fire dialogue that his films were covered with subtitles from the top to bottom. So they were not successful because you couldn't see the actors because of the subtitles.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
So was it your idea to cast him?
Oh, yeah. Well, out of necessity, because, Ragtime was a pretty expensive film, and Dino De Laurentiis needed some name so that he can pre-sell the film, not here, but in Europe. He needed money from Europe, and so he needed a name. And we didn't have any name. And so I told James, I'm making this movie. Whatever part you choose, it's yours. You want to play Evelyn Nesbitt, you'll be Evelyn Nesbitt. And he just laughed. He just laughed.
If James Cagney helped sell the production abroad to Europe, I guess they were able to subtitle his movies easier than Czechs were able to subtitle
them? They dub.
Oh, they dub in Europe and they subtitle in Czechoslovakia. That explains it. Okay.
Germany, Italy, France, they all dub. And in England,
Your last couple of movies haven't been as successful as your earlier ones. Valmont, which is based on the same story as Les Liaisons Dangereuses, but opened after the film adaptation of that Valmont flopped, and then Hell Camp, a movie that was in progress, never got made. What emotional impact did it have on you to have those two back to back?
The flop of Valmont doesn't really affect me because I did my best. I know that, and I like myself personally that film and that experience very much. And who has to grieve are the people who put up the money for the film, of course. I don't. The other case, that's worse, because, I work over a year and a half together with Adam Davidson on the script, and then I prepared the whole film with Michael Hausman as a producer. The cast was assembled here, the cast was assembled in Japan, the location found here, found in Japan, the sets were being built, and suddenly, the film collapses, so that's not very pleasant.
Do you have something else in the works now?
I didn't decide yet. I have a few projects I'm sort of flirting with, but I didn't make up my mind yet. No.
So have you kept very emotionally involved with Czechoslovakia through the Velvet Revolution and more recently through the split between the Czech lands and Slovakia?
Yes, to a certain extent, mainly because my sons are living there. Of course, now, they are coming and visit me very frequently. And of course, also because of my, childhood friend or teenage years friend, Václav Havel, who became president of Czechoslovakia, who was in the same boarding school in Czechoslovakia. And when I was 14, he was 11. It was a boarding school where... there were the bedrooms, 8, 10 kids in one bedroom. So with the little kids, younger kids, always one older kid was there like a, how would you call that person, like a...
Like an older brother?
Like an older brother, right? And I was put on this one bedroom as an older brother to this, 11-year-old kids. And I hated it because I was 14. And what kind of conversation that 14-year-old kid who starts already looking around the girl's legs, can have with 11-year-old kids. So I hated it.
So Václav Havel was
your younger
brother? And Václav
was there. He was the younger brother there, yes.
So have you seen him since he became president?
Oh, yes, I have seen him. I have a great, great admiration for him, great admiration. For him as a man and for him as a philosopher and politician.
Are you sorry your country split apart?
I guess yes and no. No, it's, from the selfish point of view, for the Czechs are better without Slovaks because they were not able to agree on anything because the power in Slovakia is still in the hands of former communists and even former fascists, And they were just not able to agree on anything. That country would be, stop at halt. So from this point of view, it's better for the Czechs, that they are separated. But there's some nostalgia. It was, it was nice to... It looked nice on the map, the whole country. I can't get used to the new shapes.
So let me ask you, in writing your memoir, Turnaround, and thinking back to your boyhood years during World War II, did you find yourself really marveling at everything you've been able to accomplish and the fact that, you know, that you survived and not only survived, but got to do something you desperately, you know, wanted to do and did it well and so on?
Well, you know, it's a funny business to write autobiography. It's funny. It's a sin.
It's a sin?
It's a sin because you can't avoid a certain kind of narcissism in it. Mm-hmm. And narcissism mm-hmm. is a sin, mm-hmm. you know. But at the same time, you go through so many contradictory feelings because it's like, it's almost as if, you know, you are the defendant, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and the judge all at once.
Right.
You know? And of course, you know, as a defendant, I am yelling, you know, I'm good. But the prosecutor in me is saying, no, you are not. You are selfish, you are arrogant, you are greedy, you know. And it goes like that. And then the book is out and...
And then the critics become the judge and jury.
Then the critics will tell you, right? But, you know, then the book is out and it's again such an ambiguous kind of very contradictory feeling because on one hand, suddenly, you know, I feel like I'm embarrassed. I feel like I'm standing naked in the middle of Times Square.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I get very angry if nobody pays any attention to me.
Miloš Forman, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been a pleasure.
You are very welcome. I thank you.
Film director Miloš Forman has written a memoir called Turnaround. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what story are you following for All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear news from Mexico City that the Mexican Attorney General now says that at least 7 people were involved in the assassination of Luis Donaldo Colosio, the candidate for president who was shot in Tijuana not long ago. We'll also be hearing today about a sentence of caning that has been meted out to an 18-year-old American in Singapore. That sentence has brought protests from Washington, from American diplomats, from the president even. We'll hear from a Singaporean, though, why people there seem to think caning is an appropriate sentence. And also news about aging in place, people retiring and staying where they are.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the past few months, the French legislature has been debating new laws protecting the language. Linguist Jeff Nunberg, who's living in France this year, weighs in with his thoughts.
There's not much you can say in defense of the new laws the French have enacted aimed at protecting their language. As of now, it's compulsory to use French in public announcements, advertising, product labels, and television programs. You can't even use a foreign word in an advertisement unless you can demonstrate that there's no French equivalent. So the billboard ads for Jurassic Park have now been changed to read Le Parc Jurassique. And the train that passes under the new Channel Tunnel has been rebaptized from Le Shuttle to La Navette. But so far as I know, there's no truth to the rumor that Bruce Springsteen's nickname will have to be changed from The Boss to Le Patron. And all seminars and conferences organized in France have to provide French translations of presentations in other languages. This is all just part of the wider campaign that the French government has been waging to insist on the status of French as a world language and to protect it from the perceived pollutions of franglais. Another new law requires that at least 40% of all songs played on the radio have to be in French. Of course, this is a futile exercise. Legislation won't stop the spread of English words or of English language mass culture. All of this has been pointed out by the press, both outside and inside France. The French magazine Globe Hebdo went so far as to publish an attack on the new laws that was written entirely in English, except for the one French word, connerie, a slightly vulgar way of referring to a stupid mistake. But I have to say that it's been a little disconcerting to see the scorn with which the measures have been greeted by the press in the English-speaking world, and particularly by the British. There were articles describing the French position as arrogant and insulting, comparing the campaign to ethnic cleansing. Several writers pointed with some satisfaction to surveys showing that the study of French is in decline in other countries. And the most hysterical overreaction appeared in an article in the London Sunday Times by one A.A. Gill, who took the new laws as an occasion to abuse the French with a vituperation of absolutely Balkan intensity. You can get a sense of the tone from the first sentence. The sad truth is, the French have never forgiven us for failing to be good Europeans and surrendering in 1940. Gill goes on to say that France has produced no literature worth reading in the last 100 years, and that the French never wash, and the only thing they excel at is prostitution. You read this and you say, excuse me, how do we get onto this subject? And in any event, where do the English come off being so smug about the linguistic troubles of the French? After all, if they're off the hook as far as learning foreign languages is concerned, it's not because Europeans have decided they prefer Shakespeare to Racine or Goethe, or because Britain has outpaced the rest of the continent economically, not hardly. If England's former colonies suddenly vanished from the earth, the English language would rate a place somewhere between Italian and Polish. So it's strange to hear the English go on as if the results of the Hundred Years' War had just come in. You think of a schoolboy who gets in a fight and calls in his 200-pound cousin for help, then stands crowing over the body of his fallen rival. But how do we Americans come off in all this? It's true that the present position of English is due mostly to our economic and cultural dominance. On the other hand, I don't know that there's much in that for us to take pride in either. When French became a world language 200 years ago, it was as the tongue of Voltaire, Diderot, Escoffier. Why shouldn't the French get shirty when they see their language yielding to the tongue of Kojak and Ronald McDonald? And it's true, too, that right now our language isn't under assault from foreign words the way French is. Or at least when we borrow words nowadays, they tend to be the names of food and garments. But that's only because most Americans are ignorant of other languages apart from what they run into on restaurant menus. So of course the distributors translate the names of foreign films when they're released in the States. Who would understand the title of Jonah Who Will Be 21 in the Year 2000 if they'd left it in French? And can you imagine an American magazine running an editorial entirely in French? Not likely, especially since enrollment in American university French courses has actually dropped in recent years. And yet, even the overwhelming dominance of English hasn't prevented us from developing our own little language protection movement. Except that ours is aimed not at safeguarding English against a genuine external onslaught, but rather at slapping down immigrants who have the temerity to ask to take their driver's license test in Spanish or Chinese. In the end, nobody emerges from these language wars covered in glory. It's the most foolish loyalty of all. You go to the wall for your home, your people, your creed, but for your syllables, quelle connerie.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Xerox European Research Center in Grenoble. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the so-called Butcher of Broadway moves to a new neighborhood. We talk to Frank Rich about his 13 years as New York Times theater critic and his new position writing op-ed columns for the Times. Also, we discuss the growing tension between the U.S. and North Korea. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.